From the Republican National Convention in San Diego, this is Democracy Now!
Now, you know, tradition is that speakers at the Republican National Convention remain at this very imposing podium. But tonight I'd like to break with tradition for two reasons. One, I'm going to be speaking to friends. And secondly, I'm going to be speaking about the man I love. And it's just a lot more comfortable for me to do that down here with you.
Liddy Does Oprah, the aspiring First Lady, takes the floor at the GOP convention.
In private, our allies will say what they dare not admit in public, that America is no longer the world leader it was under Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And sad to say, our allies are right.
Republican big guns say the U.S. is no longer the superpower it once was, and Bill Clinton's to blame, and a tour of maquiladoras on the Mexican border. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Juan Gonzalez.
For the last several days, a number of men and women have been painting a remarkable portrait of a remarkable man, a man who is the strongest and the most compassionate, most tender person that I've ever known. The man who, quite simply, is my own personal Rock of Gibraltar. And tonight I want to put the finishing brush strokes on that portrait, if you will. And Bob Dole, if you're watching, let me just warn you. I may be saying some things that you, in your modesty, would never be willing to talk about. But I think that the people you've been serving all these years in America deserve to know. They have the right to know. This is not a time to be silent. This is a defining moment, ladies and gentlemen, in our nation's history. This election is about the vision and the values that will shape America as we move into the next century. And it's about the character of the man who will lead us there. Now, thanks.
Last night, the Republican Party formally nominated Bob Dole and Jack Kemp to the GOP ticket this November, but no one can disagree that it was Elizabeth Dole who stole the show.
Let me just say, I could go on and on sharing stories about this loving husband and father, this caring friend, but please indulge a very proud wife. Just one final story, which neither I nor my 95-year-old mother will ever forget. When Bob was dating me, he used to go to North Carolina a lot to visit my parents. And one morning, unbeknownst to me, he left his bedroom and went down where Mother was fixing breakfast in the kitchen. And he had a towel over his arm and shoulder that had been disabled in the war. And he said, "Mrs. Hanford, I think you ought to see my problem." Mother said, "Bob, that is not a problem. It's a badge of honor." My fellow Americans, I believe that in the years to come, future generations will look back to this November and say, here is where Americans earned a badge of honor. Here is where we elected the president who gave us more opportunities and smaller and more efficient government, and stronger and safer families. Here is where we elected the better man who led us to a better America, because here is where we elected Bob Dole. God bless you all. Thank you.
Elizabeth Dole at the GOP convention last night, where both Bob Dole and Jack Kemp were nominated. And we're broadcasting live from San Diego. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, and Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News. What did you make of last night's events?
Well, it's a TV show, and I think it was very well staged. Primetime TV is what it was all about. The disingenuous look on Elizabeth Dole's face as she looked up at the screen in surprise to see that, of all things, Bob Dole was watching from his hotel room as she was cruising around the floor. The only real thing, I think, about the whole thing was the mic failure, which we can certainly relate to at Pacifica. She had to switch from a lapel mic to a handheld mic. But, you know, when you look at the TV ratings for this, which is really what the Republican professionals are looking at in the poll ratings, they had to try to pull something, as they will have to try to pull something tonight. The opening night, for example, with all of the networks and CNN and C-SPAN and PBS added in, had fewer than half the viewers of the Olympics opening ceremony and about a fourth of the viewers of the 1996 Super Bowl. And Bob Dole is not getting the bounce in the polls that he was looking for from this convention.
Maybe
this
if Jack Kemp just threw that football a few more times.
Or put his uniform on. But on the poll thing, Amy, that the local paper here, the San Diego Union Tribune, has been conducting a poll every single day and show that, in fact, through the second night of the convention, Bob Dole was losing ground to Bill Clinton as a result of this television show.
Well, talking about staged, Juan, maybe you can talk about a friend of yours who watched the whole thing staged yesterday.
Well, yes, this carefully choreographed situation last night, it seemed spontaneous when she went down from the podium into the crowd, Oprah style, but in reality, she rehearsed that whole presentation for close to an hour earlier in the afternoon, including the gentleman with the wheelchair that she introduced and the other individuals who had been important in Bob Dole's life in Kansas. Each one of them was there during the rehearsal period as she practiced going from one to another. So that it was, again, carefully choreographed, but effective, because she's an excellent speaker. She's got a charisma that neither Kemp nor Dole are capable of summoning up. And I think that she was effective in attempting to present Dole in a much more humane situation.
Well, I don't know how many people
light than anyone's accustomed to.
I don't know how many people noticed the detail, but the first person she went to in the audience, the 70-something-year-old nurse who had helped Bob Dole with his war wounds after the war, she introduced the woman, asked her to stand up. The woman was standing there. She's elderly now, quite uncertain about her role. Liddy Dole put her hand on her and then just walked away from her, and the woman was still standing there like, what do I do now? And her husband had to come over to her and say, it's time to sit down. It was like, you know, it sort of symbolized to me the fact that this woman was so into her role, Liddy Dole, that she didn't have any idea of the human implications of the people that were playing the role with her.
Well, it was so well done. Many might say it confirms their thought that Elizabeth Dole should have been the Republican presidential candidate. You know, it's interesting. One of the people last night on the podium said, and I should say, by the way, that let's not forget that Pete Wilson did make an appearance at the Republican convention last night. It was said that he wasn't going to be speaking. And I think that at this point, since Jack Kemp has turned around on two issues that are very dear to his heart, Jack Kemp now has said that he is supporting Prop 187 and he is against affirmative action. Pete Wilson felt that it was time that he could step forward, even if his pro-choice stance wasn't recognized at the convention. And he introduced in a couple of sentences, that's all he had, the governor of California, the former mayor of San Diego, and the host state of this convention. He introduced in a few sentences the first lady, hope-to-be, wannabe, I guess you want to say, Elizabeth Dole, and then she did come to the stand. So that was one of the little surprises last night.
You know, one of the things that this performance by Liddy Dole does last night is put a lot of pressure on the Democrats, and I'm sure this was part of the calculation as to what role Hillary Rodham Clinton will be allowed to play at the Democratic convention. It's no secret that she's been shoved back deep into the White House closet over the past few months, silent on the issue of the dreadful welfare reform bill, not allowed to speak out on the fate of children under that bill. And now, of course, she is equally, if not a superior performer in public. These are both women, Amy and Juan, who went to nearly all male law schools at a time that was very difficult to do, had to stand up against very difficult competition in speaking and moot court and arguing and debating. And each one of them can be very effective in public. Now what are the Democrats going to do with Hillary in Chicago? They have to do something. Will they try to match Liddy Dole's performance?
Well, one person that does have to match Liddy Dole's performance is Bob Dole tonight, and he is preparing for his big night. The core of his address will be his $548 billion package of tax cuts and what they call regulatory reform. Now, after the GOP, the convention last night, all of the Republicans, I shouldn't say all of them, 1 out of five are millionaires, and maybe a number of them were there, went to the Embarcadero for $1,000 a drink or $1,500 if you're a corporation ticket to go to this event that celebrated Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. And Bob Dole did address the thousands of people who were there. And what he said there really very much echoed the contract with America, no question about it. He was talking about regulatory reform. He was talking about embracing all of the things that they were talking about, something he's distanced himself from in the past. Interesting also is that Jack Kemp spoke, and he made that now famous comment, "I will be Bob Dole's right hand," referring to his right arm that was incapacitated as a result of his war wounds in during the war in World War II, and he repeated, "I will be Bob Dole's right hand."
Well, but given the way Kemp is switching around, if Bob Dole needs a left hand, he'll be that one too.
Well, I think also the other thing you noticed last night was the continued Rainbow Coalition presentation of the Republican Party to the television audience. Once again, the few non-white representatives there, whether politicians or other individuals that were brought up, Ben Nighthorse Campbell came up to speak. You had several Asian American Republicans introduced and brought to the podium. The continued attempt to present to the public a Republican Party that doesn't exist in reality.
And one, interesting you should say that. I was on the floor last night, and Larry was reading from the New York Times yesterday the piece that analyzed the amount of FaceTime for African Americans, which was far outweighed, actually, their representation here. In fact, it's gone down since 1992. So I was on the floor, and I mean, I'm exaggerating a little here, but almost every African American I saw was being interviewed, had a mic in front of him or her, or had some lights on them. But there's no question about it. And you look at the podium these days, it's almost as if it's a separatist convention. It's women and African Americans. Almost, not exclusively, but I mean, the representation, clearly they are reaching out here. They are reaching.
And the young people, too. They're trying to get more and more young people up on the podium to show something other than Bob Dole, who, of course, when he gets up there tonight, unless they manage some miraculous transformation, will be as old as he is. You were talking about his speech that he's going to give tonight, Amy. There have been 8 rewrites, according to USA Today, this morning, and 3 formal conferences during which each word of the speech was debated. Now, Mark Halperin originally wrote this speech, the novelist, the conservative who writes for the Wall Street Journal, Winter's Tale. He also, of course, wrote that famous speech when Bob Dole resigned from the Senate back in June. And Dole has spent 20 hours in a room this week alone at his campaign headquarters practicing with a teleprompter.
Well, we'll see if this speech is called A Summer's Tale. And speaking about books, you know, Bill Clinton's book is going to be out on the stands as he goes to the Democratic convention, and it's called Between Hope and History. I was wondering if the Republicans would be renaming it Beyond Hope, He's History. I don't know. But at the same time that the Republican convention is meeting here in San Diego, the Greens are now gathering for their first ever presidential nominating convention. They're gathering in Los Angeles, and no, they won't be spending around, what is it, $40 million between federal matching funds and corporate contributions, as they say. They're going to be spending less than $25,000. And yes, the never but ever candidate, Ralph Nader, will be addressing the convention.
And we're going to have a report on that, I believe, tomorrow.
Well, right now, we're going to go to another subject of the GOP convention last night. They focused on foreign policy. And 2 of the major speakers were Jean Kirkpatrick, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, as well as former Secretary of State James Baker.
Now, reasonable people can differ on foreign policy, but I believe that all Americans can agree on 3 critical principles to guide our foreign policy. The first is maintaining America's military superiority. We need to begin building an anti-ballistic missile system now. America must have the means, and it must have the will to defend itself and its allies. The second principle of American foreign policy, my friends, must be restoring our hard-won credibility. Above all, we need to cease making empty threats of military action, as we did in both Bosnia and Somalia. My friends, a president of the United States should never, never, never threaten the use of force unless he is damn well prepared to back it up with action. If you're not going to pull the trigger, don't point the gun. The third principle of American foreign policy must be strengthening presidential leadership. Ronald Reagan understood the meaning of leadership when he declared that the Cold War could only be won through American strength. And as he promised, the Berlin Wall came down and communism collapsed. George Bush understood the meaning of leadership when he said that Saddam Hussein's aggression would not stand. And as he promised, Kuwait was liberated and Iraq's army expelled. Bill Clinton promised nothing, and he delivered even less.
Secretary of State, former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, addressing the GOP convention last night, on the third night of the convention, tonight, the last night. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Larry Bensky. Juan will be joining us a little later in the hour as we talk about immigration and go down to the border. But we're joined by two guests right now. Bob Borisaj is with us from Washington. He's with the Campaign for New Priorities and the Institute for Policy Studies. And we're joined by New Jersey conservative Republican Chris Smith. And he was on the convention floor last night where I met up with him. Why don't we start with Chris Smith, your reaction to James Baker's words?
Well, I think, Amy, that Secretary Baker made some excellent points, especially the whole idea of empty threats. You know, I remember because I was in Bosnia, I was in Croatia, I chair the Helsinki Commission and also the International Operations and Human Rights Subcommittee, was there right when the war broke out, saw that there were some mistakes made early on, which everyone recognized. Bill Clinton came on the scene and said we need to lift and strike, that the arms embargo was wrong, and then for 30 months did virtually nothing except talk. It wasn't until the Croatians showed their ability to reclaim areas and put the Serbs to flight that all of a sudden he was the one who stepped in and said, let's put together a group called IFOR in order to deploy there. Thousands of people died. There was a clear consensus. We passed legislation that Steny Hoyer, a Democrat, offered on the floor to lift the arms embargo, and he vetoed that legislation. Prime Minister or former Prime Minister Šalajić said over and over again, we don't want U.S. troops. We want the means to defend ourselves. And thousands of people needlessly died after there was a clear consensus on the Democrat side of the aisle and the Republican side of the aisle to really do something to try to end that horrible conflict. We saw the same kind of flip-flopping and vacillation vis-a-vis the People's Republic of China.
Well, can we stay for a moment with Bosnia Congressman and
sure.
Bob Borisaj?
Hey, Bob.
I seem to remember the words lift and strike coming out of the words of out of the mouth of Bob Dole as well. Many of the critics of foreign policy and students of foreign policy say right now foreign policy is really bipartisan. When it comes down to what Congress tries to do and talks to itself behind the scenes, there really isn't much difference between the Democrats and Republicans. Wasn't Bob Dole for the same policy as Bill Clinton?
Yes, but the problem is Bill Clinton vetoed the legislation that would have made the difference. We sent him a bill that had passed, and you're right, overwhelmingly in a bipartisan way, a 2-to-1 margin on the House side, and he vetoed it. And we saw the same kind of vacillation, and I think it's important to say this. He established an excellent executive order on human rights and most favored nation status for China. 1 year later, human rights had deteriorated, and then he lifts the executive order and absolutely delinks human rights from trade.
Congressmember Chris Smith, we're going to come back to this issue in a minute, and we're going to get Bob Borisaj's reaction after this break on Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from San Diego at the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky. Our guests are New Jersey Republican Chris Smith, speaking to us from his hotel here in San Diego, and Bob Borisaj, who's with us from Washington. He's with the Institute for Policy Studies. Last night, foreign policy was on the agenda of the GOP convention. Bob Borisaj, your response to what Congressman Smith just was talking about around Bosnia and human rights.
Well, in general, I think it's quite clear that we have a pretty broad consensus about policy in most places of the world now. On Bosnia, neither party knew what the devil to do. No one had an appetite about going in and getting enmeshed there. Clinton came in basically following the Bush policy, asked the allies to join together in beginning to arm the Bosnians. The allies refused, so he did it covertly rather than overtly and vetoed the bill that would have really infuriated our allies. But I think those are all distinctions without difference. What you have a consensus on in both parties is that America will sustain this global police role, that we will not invest in building international peacekeeping, and that we are sacrificing human rights generally, not just in China, but in Indonesia and elsewhere, for trade.
Congressman Smith, your reaction to the United Nations spokesperson's extraordinary statement yesterday, Silvana Foa, criticizing the Republican Party platform, which is something that I don't think the United Nations has ever done in any way, shape, or form, for just the point that Bob Borisaj was talking about, implicating that in the Republican Party platform that the United Nations should not be supported by the United States because it is, in effect, a foreign power.
Problems we've seen with peacekeeping highlighted some of the incompetence of the mandates that the international community gave to the Blue Helmets. And I say that, you know, knowing that the peacekeepers themselves are very often very courageous people who put their lives on the line. They got the Nobel Peace Prize not so long ago, and I believe they deserved it. But the international will doesn't exist to do what has to be done to give the kind of authority when it has to be given. And I think that's a lack of U.S. leadership as well. We were very, we were not as assertive as we could have been, I think, over and over again with regards to UNPR 4. And you know, one of the things that James Baker said about empty threats, I'll never forget when Ilie Wiesel turned to Bill Clinton and said, "Do something, Mr. President," talking about Bosnia. And for about a week and a half, Bill Clinton sounded like George Patton in terms of his rhetoric, and then very quickly Bosnia faded off the screens. So while there was a consensus, as Bob pointed out, on some of these issues, and hopefully there is bipartisanship, the real fact of the matter is that for some 30 months, despite prodding by Congress, the administration, the Clinton administration, did virtually nothing except, you know, encourage some action rather than lead. And that's where the empty threats comes in. Every dictatorship around the world took note of that, took note of the way we have coddled dictators in Beijing. It's one thing to believe that linking trade with human rights or not linking it leads to a certain outcome. It's quite another to stake the credibility of the United States on saying unless there is significant progress in human rights in China, MFN is a goner, and then to say absolutely deterioration in every category, the use of the Lao Gai, the use of other kinds of torture against individuals. I met with Wei Jingsheng for 3 hours in Beijing when he was, during a very brief time, let out of prison. And the sense of disappointment, almost to the point of despair, on the part of many in the dissident community that Bill Clinton was going to waffle, and eventually he did just a few months later, was very telling.
Congressman Smith, we want to break in for a minute to play a bit of Jean Kirkpatrick, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She also addressed the convention floor last night.
Americans will choose in November between men with very different views concerning the uses of American power. Unfortunately, Bill Clinton and his administration do not understand how to protect and preserve American strength and credibility. For this reason, they make threats they do not carry out. They accept promises on which they never collect. They acquiesce in the mistreatment of American officials, as when the Serbs shot down an unarmed American plane on a routine flight over Serbia, but paid no price. As when Fidel Castro's MiGs blew Americans piloting unarmed Cessnas out of the sky over international waters off of Florida, and paid no price. Or as when the president simply accepts, without protest, Syria's insulting treatment of his Secretary of State, or China's threats to rain missiles on Los Angeles. Bob Dole notes with concern the spreading attacks against Americans in the World Trade Center, in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps on TWA 800. Bob Dole observes that when the United States loses credibility, the world becomes a dangerous place.
Gene Kirkpatrick last night here at the Republican Convention. Bob Borisaj, what about this attitude on the part of some of the Republicans now that the United States can't support dictatorships? In my lifetime, I remember the United States blithely and in a bipartisan manner, for the most part, supporting dictatorships in Chile, in Cuba, in Nicaragua. And now all of a sudden, Republicans are saying we can't support a dictatorship in China. What's going on here?
Well, I don't think that's their position. The Republican position is that we will trade with China no matter what they do, because we want those markets, and the people who pay for their party want those markets.
That doesn't sound like Chris Smith's position.
Well, the Republican position is also that we will support feudal dictatorships in Saudi Arabia and throughout the Persian Gulf that are literally built on sand, because underneath the sand is oil that we want. And so there's this rhetoric out of the Republican convention is politics, not policy. On policy, there is far less disagreement. And it is rather shocking that Gene Kirkpatrick and James Baker, who were involved at the height of the high levels of the Reagan administration, which, after all, sent Marines into Lebanon, pointed the gun, had 47 Marines slaughtered, and fled the next day without anyone paying any price, to use Ms. Kirkpatrick's phrase, would have the temerity to get up on a national stage, assume that we've all forgotten that instance, and rail about Bill Clinton's foreign policy. The reality is that much flip-flopping and floundering as the Clinton administration has done, it has not made mistakes like Reagan did in Lebanon or Bush in Iraq that cost Americans' lives.
You know, in 1980, Gene Kirkpatrick wrote a paper for the American Enterprise Institute praising the Salvadoran general Hernandez Martinez for the Matanza of 1932, in which at least 20,000 people were killed. She praised him as a hero, saying that he had restored order and civic peace. I want to talk about the Reagan policy around human rights, but then to go to Chris Smith and ask you about something you've done where you've really broken with a lot of the Republicans and Democrats in your campaign against child labor, and really raising the issue of corporations, something that both sides of the aisle are loath to do. We'll go to that in just 30 seconds. Coming up in our next hour, we'll talk to Sarah Diamond about the Christian Coalition. We'll look at a millionaire's party here at the GOP convention, although it's not just them. We'll talk to Chuck Lewis, and we'll be talking to Molly Ivan. She'll be talking about the convention that she's been watching. So stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Here in San Diego. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, and we're talking to New Jersey Congressmember, Republican Congressmember Chris Smith and Bob Borisaj of the Institute for Policy Studies. I wanted to get Bob's reaction to what Chris Smith has been doing, but Chris, maybe you can describe your campaign against child labor. I really haven't seen the likes of this in a while in Congress, where you have been, well, you were the one who brought Kathy Lee Gifford in, and it was because you brought in someone else, Charlie Kernaghan, who attacked child labor and corporate corporate irresponsibility in Central America.
Amy, we've had two very good and incisive hearings in my subcommittee dealing with the issue of child labor, and the second hearing did have Mrs. Gifford as our guest, and she really spoke out boldly as to why she thought it was an exploitation of children and why we needed to stop it, and she did endorse the legislation I've introduced that would impose sanctions on those countries that engage in child labor. It would also make a significant contribution to the ILO, which is doing yeoman's work with meager resources to try to combat child labor and the exploitation of children, to craft strategies on a country-by-country basis to hopefully eradicate it. You know, start with the most extreme cases and hopefully make it, you know, as less as possible throughout the world.
Bob Borisaj, let me ask you something.
Yes.
The sweatshop summit really very much came out of Chris Smith's hearings because it brought Kathy Lee Gifford to the fore by bringing Charlie Kernaghan forward, who attacked her as well as other corporations who were running sweatshops around the world. President Clinton has been one of the largest pusher of arms sales around the world to places like Indonesia. He's now trying to sell some F-16s, one of the worst dictatorships in the world today. This is something he's been doing for quite a while now. He continues the tradition, he just intensifies it. What do you make of this conservative Republican taking a stance that many would say liberal Democrats would have championed years ago?
And liberal Democrats do champion now. I think it's incredibly important what Representative Smith has done, and I think these initiatives have to be built. And in both parties, hopefully there will be a fight about this what is now the reigning policy of both parties, that trade trumps everything and that all other values have to take a back seat to markets and trade. And Representative Smith's work is the beginning of that on the Republican side. Charlie Kernaghan's work is the beginning of that on the Democratic Party side. And I think you'll see on the liberal side of the party more and more efforts to build labor rights and human rights and environmental protections into trade treaties, into bilateral relations, and into American policy.
Well, it remains to be seen what role that'll play in the Democratic Convention in 2 weeks in Chicago, and that'll be interesting for us to follow on our Pacifica broadcast. I wanted to change the subject slightly for both of you and direct your attention to something that I saw last night as I was watching the convention, which seemed to me to be right in a historical trend and a disturbing one. Back in the 19th century, politicians had a tradition of something that was called waving the bloody shirt. I think it actually came out of Andrew Jackson's campaign way back in the early 19th century. And last night, a lot of speakers were trying to legitimize Bob Dole as a president because of his heroism in World War II, his undoubted heroism, his admirable heroism in World War II. But on the other side of the spectrum, we never hear Bob Borisaj anything about people who evidenced a great deal of courage and heroism in not going to war during the Vietnam period, or in World War II for that matter. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of draft resistors who made a serious moral decision did not, of course, risk their lives physically, but risk their careers and their futures, many of them going into exile. Why is it that that is still not considered something that can be discussed as a point of pride? And, of course, President Clinton leads the nation in not discussing that as a point of pride. But why is that something that is not equally of valor and of principle in electoral politics? First, Bob Borisaj, then Chris Smith.
Well, I think electoral politics is the right phrase. People count votes, and there are more veterans than there are people who resisted the draft and were right about the Vietnam War being an immoral war that we should not have been involved in. And so politicians who do count votes are not about to touch that one. I think what you've seen in the public is a slightly different attitude, though, which is, while I think generally while the public will pay tribute to Bob Dole for the sacrifice he made in World War II, that they have learned not to hold the lack of service or the people who fought against the Vietnam War, to hold that against them. And so Newt Gingrich, for example, who didn't serve, or Bill Clinton or others, people are quite happy to vote for without seeing it as a necessary attribute for a politician. It used to be at the end of World War II that if you weren't a veteran, you weren't going to be elected to office. I think at the end of Vietnam, you can have resisted the draft or certainly avoided it, and you can still go forward in national politics, as both Gingrich and Clinton show.
Congressman Smith, you serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee. What's your take on this question?
Well, you know, one thing with Bill Clinton, his past as well as his current policies, but his past life always seems to be under reconstruction in some way, putting additional spins, changes. And we saw that with the big flap about his very resistance, which if it's done out of deeply held moral conviction is a is something that I think everybody can respect. The problem is, and I think Bob alluded to it, is that, you know, he probably has made the political calculation that this might not sell, therefore he goes through another metamorphosis about actually what he did and why he did it and to what extent did he do it. And I think that's part of the problem with Clinton. It's a changing, you got someone who was like malleable clay or constantly being remolded and changed. That is one of the major contrasts between him, he and Senator Dole. There's consistency, what you say is what you get, and to a very large extent, he, over the years, has been very true to his core convictions.
You know, I wanted to ask you...
Well, wait a minute. We just watched Bob Dole go through a transfusion in the last 3 weeks where he turned from being somebody who cared about deficits to being somebody who's offering supply-side voodoo economics, which he denounced for decades. He's turned from being somebody who supports civil rights to somebody...
Wait a minute, one at a time. Finish Bob Borisage, then we'll give you Mr. Smith a chance.
And so, in fact, we've seen that what afflicts Clinton afflicts Bob Dole, too, which is that they're both politicians and they are reframing themselves to fit where they think they ought to be.
Congressman Smith, what about this change of
policy? As to who you are and what you did when you were of a certain age isn't something that it lends itself to evolution. You know, he always plays majoring and minoring, and depending on what the political winds will take.
Well, we have to say actually the same, Congressman Smith, for Jack Kemp, who has just now turned around on Proposition 187, which he was against. Now he says he's for it, and on affirmative action, which he was for, and now he says he's against it, to conform with the Republican Party platform and Bob Dole. But Chris Smith, I wanted to ask both of you on the issue of arms and weapons and money in the convention, and they all really go together as we wrap up this discussion. There is a tremendous amount of money pouring into this convention from the telecommunications giants. You see them all over their hospitality suites, their signs, to the arms manufacturers, the weapons contractors. Chris Smith, you're very much alone, I think. You're a maverick on the issue of human rights. But what do you make of this party, the Democratic Party as well, that is really so much, and we see it played out more than ever here, beholden to these special interests, the big money interests?
Well, I think that there needs to be much more transparency, less influence by, you know, these larger corporations and by the labor unions and the like. You know, what's happening internationally, and we talked about this last night, Amy, is atrocious in terms of arming the world. Remember the We Are the World song? The Capitol Steps did a parody on that. We arm the world. Regrettably, that continues to be the case under Bill Clinton, as it was under previous administrations. Human rights don't matter in this administration. Amnesty International has come before my subcommittee and said human rights is an island in this administration. They talk a good game, but there's no connection.
But the Republican leadership has been no different.
Well, I'm part of the leadership. I chair the International Operations Committee, which is the lead committee on human rights. We're trying to change it. And to try to put some real linkage to human rights and other policies,
Bob
like
Borisage,
trade and norms.
Final comment.
Well, I think the leadership of both parties is very much in the pay of the large interests that pay for their parties, and that in both parties, I think you see a struggle among voters, among people, for where that party is going to go. And I think in the Democratic Party, you're going to see more and more of a struggle on the progressive side of people trying to take back their party and the future of the country
to
put forth values that we believe in.
We'll see if that progressive side rears its head at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and we'll certainly be there. We want to thank Bob Borisage of the Institute for Policy Studies, and we want to thank Chris Smith, Republican Congressmember from New Jersey. Up next, we're going to be talking about immigration, and we're going down to the border. You're listening to Democracy Now! From San Diego. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Larry has just left, and Juan Gonzalez is in his seat of the Daily News, and Juan has been following immigration. We're also joined by Chuy Varela, who is the public affairs director at our sister station, KPFA. I'm thinking of my BAI perspective here, Pacifica station, KPFA, in Berkeley. And he, too, has been going down to the border. Chuy and I went down yesterday to Mexico to look at the maquiladoras. But Juan, you stayed here in the San Diego area.
Yes, Amy. I attended yesterday a swearing-in ceremony for about 350 immigrants who were becoming U.S. citizens. This is happening on a weekly basis here. And was able to attend the ceremony and then interview some of the people that were coming out and registering to vote.
Hereby declare on oath that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, host state,
That was a U.S. District Judge John Rhodes swearing in 350 new American citizens at the Masonic Lodge here in San Diego. And this is happening on a weekly basis. Amazingly, of the 350 people who were sworn in, the overwhelming majority, I'd say about two-thirds of them, were Mexican American immigrants. The rest were largely, there were a good group of Filipinos, some Vietnamese, and then a scattering of others. And as they emerged from the swearing-in ceremony with their families and relatives, because there were over 1,000 people there, there were groups waiting to register them to vote outside, including Al Ducheney, who is with the Podemos Votar project in San Diego, and who had some interesting things to say about that project as it's been developing all this past year.
This is the We Can Vote Podemos Votar registration project.
And I heard at the Latino Summit that there's been a tremendous increase in people becoming citizens and registering. And
absolutely. Absolutely. We have now, in the last year, the number of registered people who are becoming citizens and being sworn in have tripled. Okay. Today, in this hearing today, we have perhaps 75% are Hispanics. Mm-hmm. This was much different than it was a year ago when I started this project, and we were doing maybe the 30% Hispanics. Mm-hmm. So it's been tremendous, the increase of new citizens who are Latinos.
And what do you attribute that to? That it's a sudden surge of people who are deciding to become citizens.
Well, it's very clear that part of it is certainly the debating the immigrant bashing on the part of the Republicans and the Pete Wilson especially today, and you can tell by the registrations of the Hispanics that we are registering, a good 80% are registering as Democrats. Given, and it's really easy to choose, given the choice between Bill Clinton, a Democrat, and Pete Wilson, a Republican, it's immediate that they
register. How does that compare, let's say, to a year ago? Was there more Hispanics registering Republican, or is it?
Quite frankly, it was pretty close even during that period of time. When it just started, it was still more Democratic, but it was a lot closer, more Republicans. Now, with the 187, with the anti-affirmative action, with the immigrant bashing, it's pretty incredible.
Not only were those numbers have been changing, but I found that most of the people had been in the United States for many years and were now suddenly, after 20, 30 years, deciding to become a citizen. One of those was Araceli Hernandez, who was born in Puebla, Mexico, but who has lived in the United States since the age of 5. And I asked her why she had decided to become a U.S. citizen.
You know what? I just evaluated life, I guess. Mm-hmm. My brother, my oldest brother, he has served in the Army for many years. And it's, I just thought, I think it's something I have to do. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a little bit for him. Uh-huh. And I guess mostly, I just felt like it was, you know.
Anything in the atmosphere in the country now in terms of a lot of the laws that are being passed that made you think maybe I better do it now than wait?
Well, you know, we sometimes sit and complain about how the laws that get passed and so forth. Well, we have to put our input in it, too. We can't just sit back and complain, and yet we don't vote. So I think that's another reason too, because this way I can my two cents in there too. Right. Whether, you know, things happen my way or not, at least I've got to I can put my two cents in it.
Okay. And what kind of a work did you?
I work for a credit union, Mission Federal.
That was Araceli Hernandez, who just became a U.S. citizen yesterday. The amazing thing, though, is there's no one is taking into account what I'm going to begin calling the immigration backlash that has occurred around the country. The numbers of Latinos that are becoming citizens and registering to vote, especially in states like California and Texas, is going to be decisive in this election. The Southwest Voter Registration Project, for instance, estimates that there will be that there were 1.2 million Latinos registered to vote in California in 1992. There will be 1.7 million, a 500,000 increase this year. In Texas, similar increases. And altogether, the Latino vote in this election is expected to go from about 4.2 million in 92 to 5 million. In a close election, especially in states like Texas and California, this could be a decisive, especially the fact that they're registering Democratic in such large numbers.
You know, as I hear Araceli Hernandez talking about why she's becoming a citizen, and as Chewy went and I went down to the border yesterday to hear refugees and also people who come over the border to work talk, I think of the contrast to a report I saw yesterday on CNN. When they referred to immigrants, they showed young men chained to each other being detained against a chain fence, you know, clearly looking like criminals. And this is the immigrant element that we have to deal with.
Yes, and I think that the reality is that many of the people that I interviewed, these were people who were in their 60s and their 50s, who had been here for years and years, who had just never bothered to get around to becoming U.S. citizens. But now the fear that has spread across the land because of these anti-immigration laws is changing this. These are hardworking people who have been contributing to this country for years and just never bothered to even think of becoming U.S. citizens.
Juan, immigration has certainly become a hot-button issue with this Republican convention, with the media buzz following Jack Kemp's not-so-surprising switch on the issue. Previously, Kemp vocally opposed California Proposition 187. That's the California ballot measure that would cut off public services to undocumented immigrants. But since he accepted Bob Dole's hand in political marriage, Kemp has quickly changed his tune and now says he backs Dole's position on immigration. One commentator says Kemp's turnarounds on immigration affirmative action mean he's caught the bad bug of Clintonitis. Well, the GOP tried to seize the upper hand on the issue last night on the convention floor.
We are a very generous country, but our generosity should not be mistaken for foolishness or weakness. While reaching out to all, we must do more to stop the flow of illegal immigrants. To those who come to America legally, we open our arms, we open our hearts. America can be a dream come true. To those who break the laws of our land, we will control our borders with every ounce of our determination. I am appalled that Bill Clinton's call for immigration reform goes out only when the camera lights turn on. And then he expects us to bear the burden of his indifference and negligence. We are the party of change. We are the party of results and reform. We are the party of mainstream and Main Street America. Bill Clinton is out of step and out of touch. And come this November, he's going to be tossed out of office by the Honorable Bob Dole of Kansas. Thank you very much.
Well, immigration is an issue that we've been talking about now through the week because it is such a key issue for so many in this country and also outside of this country who want to come here. Along the U.S.-Mexico border, it's estimated that there are more than 220 foreign owners of maquiladora assembly plants that manufacture everything from cars to various electronic components. NAFTA brought an increase of these factories because of lax environmental regulations and low wages. Well, right now, the average weekly wage for a 48-hour week is between $30 and $40 and no benefits. That's a 48-hour week, $30 and $40 and no benefits. Many of the companies relocated to the border in hopes of increasing their profit margin. But as Chewy Varela reports, they've done little to improve working and environmental conditions.
As we enter Colonia Industrial, one of the largest business parks in the Maquiladora zone of Tijuana, you can't miss the names of internationally known electronic companies like Sanyo, Maxell, Nashiba, and many others. Despite the work that these industries have brought to this depressed Mexican city, the toxic damage is causing severe health problems, as Mary Tong of the Support Committee for Maquiladora Workers in San Diego explains.
Here in Chilpancingo, the community itself did a survey, which I'm sure would not be accepted as scientific within the medical community in the U.S., but they basically went door to door to ask to find out how many women had babies born without brains, which is a phenomena that's been happening more and more in areas of the border where there's toxic waste dumping.
With the dumping of lead and other chemicals into the ground, the impact on children is devastating. Metales Hidrativas is a car battery recycling plant that went out of business after a strike and just packed up and walked away without cleaning up. Nina Lashin is a volunteer with the Maquiladora Support Committee.
This is a canyon which ends up at the ocean, so that we may see ourselves as discrete individuals or discrete nations bounded by borders. But actually, these chemicals are going to flow into the U.S., and they're going to affect the other side of the border. This constructed border is not going to divide us. It will not divide us as human beings who will work together for justice, and it will not divide us as human beings who can exploit people on the other side and poison them. It will poison us as well.
Even though the maquiladora industry is booming, the frustration that Mexican workers are feeling around abusive labor and environmental conditions continues to create tensions between the companies and the workers. For Pacifica Radio, this is Chuy Varela.
And Chuy Varela joins us right now here at Democracy Now! Chuy and Juan, you've both been to the border. Chuy and I went there yesterday into Mexico. This is a story that we're not getting broadcast here from San Diego, although it is so close. What, 15 minutes away from the Mexican border?
No, right. I think one of the things, Amy, that we saw yesterday was to see the stark contrast between the industrial parks that are being built by largely U.S.-owned and Japanese-owned, Korean-owned multinationals, and then to see the stark contrast into the neighborhoods where many of these workers are living. You know, workers that are building homes made out of materials that they find that are being put as trash by many of these maquiladoras, you know, pallets, you know, boards and things like that. And we visited one of those communities, which was founded by a woman named Aurora Pelayo, who is part of the Comité Urbano Popular. And the name of their community was called Colonia Vista Bonita. They're in Tijuana. And what they were essentially was a squatters movement that went and occupied a portion of the Tijuana dump and began to stay there and petition and march to try to get this community built. We've heard about some of the hardships that they've gone through as far as their work, that they don't make enough to be able to feed their families and to be able to keep their kids in school. So as a result, that by the time the youth become between 12 and 15, they're going to work. And so we're talking about basically three income families, you know, that are trying to utilize that to be able to make it, you know, to get the basic staples, to be able to, you know, live in that the one environment.
Aurora,
well, the amazing thing to me is that here we are at the Republican convention. The Republican Party was espousing and pushing NAFTA, the main party that really pushed NAFTA and finally got it over with the assistance of President Clinton. And yet,
huge assistance.
And yet you have the reality that there's been no discussion. They've been talking, for instance, in foreign policy about Bosnia,
missiles.
About missiles, about what's going on with Eastern Europe. There's been no mention of Mexico to speak of in terms of the U.S. Policy. And here we are in the largest border city in the United States, and no mention of Mexico, because obviously there's been some problems in Mexico in a variety of ways since NAFTA was passed, and the issues of what's happening with the industrialization of maquilas, what's happening, why are so many immigrants from Mexico coming to the United States, is something that the convention would rather not get into.
You know, Aurora, who Chuy was just mentioning, was commenting on what has happened since NAFTA and saying, you know, was there a big change? Oh, only that a presidential candidate was assassinated, Colosio, of the PRI party. The peso dropped dramatically, and the Zapatista revolution began in southern Mexico. She said, yes, there's been major change. Now, she went to jail, didn't she, for her stand on squatters and trying to get some little bit of land for her and her people.
Exactly, and they also talked about people that were disappeared, people that were basically beat up, you know, punished for trying to organize. But, you know, the strength of these folks were tremendous, because one of the reasons that Aurora Pelayo was able to be freed from jail was the fact that people rallied around her, where they had massive marches that included thousands of people, and they were able to make a statement to the government.
Well, we asked her for her message to both Bob Dole and President Clinton in this election year.
Yo primero que todo diría que estamos pidiendo en México If I was going to send one message to the candidates, to the U.S. presidency, to Clinton and to Dole, it would be this, that that NAFTA be changed, be renegotiated to include the rights of immigrant workers, the rights to equality of workers on both sides, the right to respect of the immigrant worker and all that they represent, to not suffer the kind of humiliation and mistreatment. That above all things is, I think, what the presidents, if they were really interested in humanity, would dedicate themselves to.
One of the issues that I wanted to bring up has to do with independent unions in Mexico. One of the things that many people have attempted to do is to try to have independent elections, and as a result, there's been a lot of trials and tribulations, a lot of abuse, and there is an incident that happened that Mary Tong told us about with Plásticos, a plastic manufacturing plant that attempted to do this, and basically what happened, the company came in, brought in a whole bunch of goon squads, and they strong-armed a lot of the people into basically voting out loud for their candidates, and as a result, the union, independent union effort failed. And one of the things people are saying is that there's a giant facade here about the official Mexican union, which is the Comité Revolucionario Obrero Mexicano, which a lot of times is just basically a front, so to make it look like there's some kind of union representation, but
which
not really doing.
Which, of course, helps U.S. corporations that are doing business there. Juan, do you think we're going to see any different to the Democratic Convention? Is there really a different attitude there?
Well, there clearly is a much larger group that is opposed to NAFTA and will raise the issue, and I think that there may be a little bit even more dissent in the Democratic Convention. There has been virtually no dissent in this convention.
Well, we'll see if there's dissent on the Democratic Convention floor. It'll be interesting. Well, folks, that wraps up this edition of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. We had help from Kathy Still, Mark Beavis, Bill Wax, Naomi Goffman, and Chewy Varela. Thanks for joining us, Chewy. Thanks very much to Michael Yoshida, our engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tonight wraps up the Republican Convention, and we'll be back tomorrow with final words. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From the Republican National Convention in San Diego, this is Democracy Now! The Christian Coalition is fired up and ready to win the 1996 elections.
Well, the next 10 weeks, our job is to turn out the pro-family vote. We're going to be distributing 45 million voter guides. We're going to be contacting 2.5 to 5 million households by letter or phone, and we're going to be registering 1 million Christians to vote.
The GOP raises over $6.5 million at its record convention gala last night. Chuck Lewis will join us to talk about what political favors money can buy. And the one and only Molly Ivan shares her take on the convention so far. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in San Diego with our national affairs correspondent, Larry Bensky.
One boy for sale, he's going cheap, mostly. only 7 guineas. That's all that amounts. Small boy.
Well, many of you have long known that the Republican Party represents the interests of wealthy America, and many of you probably have suspected that this week's convention in San Diego is largely a gathering of rich folk. But here's a statistic that deserves repetition, so listen up and pass it on. Nearly 20% of the delegates here are millionaires. That's right, 1 in 5 Republicans here are millionaires, and that's just the delegates. We are also surrounded by corporations, corporate lobbyists, big donors to the Republican Party. So as we are here with the nation's rich elite, we thought it important to talk about what all that money is buying. We're joined by Chuck Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity, author of The Buying of the President, Larry.
Chuck Lewis, even the corporate establishment media seems to have caught on to the secret here this time in San Diego. The Wall Street Journal yesterday gave a long series of examples of how United Airlines and other companies are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars here. It's going into the parties. It's going into individual politicians' PACs. And the journal concludes, the events unfolding here offer tangible evidence of how completely unregulated the campaign finance system has become. Watergate-era reforms have been rendered all but meaningless by lax enforcement, loose interpretations, and recent court decisions that are increasingly hostile to government regulation of politics. Your impression?
Well, I read that particular article. I agreed with that sentiment. I mean, it's dead right. What's happened is all the Watergate reforms, basically individual contribution limits, conventions that were given taxpayer money to be put on, all those things have been subverted and circumvented by politicians. And you have a situation now where basically they will do whatever they want to do. There's a wink and nod exercise that goes on between the party officials and the politicians and the special interests that are giving them all the cash. And everyone understands inside all the players understand that there will be no enforcement, that it's virtually impossible, that if the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, ever brings an action, it'll take years. And that's where we are in 1996.
24 years ago, when the Republicans wanted to have their convention here in San Diego, there was the famous ITT scandal, where a $400,000 payment came from ITT. It was considered to be a bribe to try to get the Nixon-era Justice Department to drop antitrust action against them. Nowadays, $400,000... wouldn't have paid for Tom DeLay's golf outing the other day, where he had corporate lobbyists paying $4,500 to sponsor a foursome. He got over 100 of them, plus $1,000 for individuals, so the majority whip of the House, the Texas Republican Tom DeLay, got more than $400,000 in just one golf game.
Yeah, what is amazing is the amounts of money are dwarfing anything we've ever seen over a two-decade-plus period. And it's as though all of these politicians have had some sort of political amnesia or even a lobotomy when it comes to the subject of money in politics. And in particular, the Republican Party was devastated by the Watergate scandal. They lost many seats in the House and Senate. They thought about changing their name as a party. And they are here just taking tens of millions of dollars. The two parties in these conventions in August, both parties, will take in over $50 million from corporate sources, mostly. There will be some labor sources with the Democrats. But the amount of giving, the size of the checks, when you have Amway giving a $1.3 million check, one check, it's just mind-boggling. And the average American, I fear, if they think about it at all, think that we have some system in place that kind of keeps track of it and kind of regulates it. And the message here is, whatever system you think we have, it's a joke.
Now, we have one special little wrinkle here in San Diego in 1996 that astonishes even jaded old souls, perhaps like you and me, which is that the Republicans themselves are sponsoring their own TV coverage, paying for it, $1.2 million. They tried to get a donation from Amway, but that doesn't seem to have worked for one reason or another. So they're paying for it themselves out of their federal money. And they're taking this money and giving it to Pat Robertson's television operation an operation which, in many people's opinion, especially mine, is illegal anyway under FCC rules. He's used it basically for political purposes. It's supposed to be a religious channel. But in any case, this is public funds, $1.3 million, coming out of the Treasury, going through the Republican laundry machine and into Pat Robertson's pocket so that they can put on full television coverage on Pat Robertson's channel without the intermediaries, such as they are, of television journalists.
Exactly. No, that was appalling to me, and the situation that we have today is anything goes. There is simply no rule or law that is in place for any of these things, and everyone gets something out of it. The Republican Party gets something out of it. Pat Robertson obviously gets something out of it. The Republican Party folks who want to watch it get something out of it. But it is taxpayer matching funds that is purveying the image and the message of one party out over the airwaves. You have deregulation at this point of not only basically de facto of our federal election process, but you also have, of course, the same thing with our Federal Communications Commission and what how things can be broadcast and what the obligations are, et cetera, there too. And so the whole thing is rather grim. And I have to say, the Amway thing, the most obnoxious thing to me with Amway, that story, what before it collapsed, is that they were using a tourist bureau, a quasi-governmental entity, to launder the money. The idea that taxpayers of San Diego are helping, or were at one time helping the Republican Party to get its message out on the airwaves is just unfathomable to me. And what's happening is we're all numb at this point. We've heard so many stories like this. It's, you know, you become numb after a while and you can't react to it. And it's like, oh, there's another one. Someone said it's shooting whales in a barrel for journalists. There are so many examples.
But the public, of course, generally, I mean, if you interview people, as I often do, or go to some place that's out of the mainstream and talk to people about the political system, they all pretty much share a universal cynicism about it, saying they're all bought and sold. You know, big money buys this, big money buys that. They may not have a very progressive analysis about why that is or what should be done about it, but I think there's a general sense in the American people's minds that the political system is extremely corrupted by money.
Well, no, I think that's absolutely right. And here's the problem. 80 to 90% of the American people say they want the process cleaned up. There's a complete consensus, absolutely no question about that, that it should be cleaned up. It's the how part, that there is no national consensus today. Even in the reform community, that there are differences of opinion about the best ways to do this. And so you have literally a disconnect here between politicians who say they believe in reform and basically through inertia and or insincerity, nothing ever happens. For two decades, politicians have promised to change the process, and for two decades, nothing has happened. The frustration level is mounting year after year. The American people sense that the foxes don't want to lock themselves out of the hen house, and in fact, they don't. And I don't know when this will exactly, how it will manifest itself. Something is fermenting here that I think for the democracy, actually, ultimately, it will be a very good thing, but it's... I don't know how long it will take to ferment, and I think what we need at the moment is a national consensus. The public has got to gain a sense of what they believe in and what they want, and that requires leadership sometimes.
And we don't seem to be getting that, certainly not here in San Diego at the 1996 Republican Convention. We're talking with Charles Lewis, a former investigative reporter for ABC, as well as a producer for 60 Minutes. He now is executive director of the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Amy, you've been following the tobacco beat here and the long nicotine-stained trail of dollars that is parading through San Diego. What's going on?
I think the National Journal had a pretty good yesterday. That's the convention daily that's put out around here at the convention center, calling Republican National Convention an upscale version of Tobacco Road. And we were talking about tobacco yesterday on the program. One of the things they say is that there are two big pleasure boats in the harbor, the Electra, a 90-foot yacht, and the Mantis, a somewhat smaller catamaran. The vessels have been rented by UST, the country's largest maker of smokeless tobacco products, and Philip Morris. And Larry, you were just talking with Chuck Lewis about Tom DeLay, the House Majority Whip. Well, he too has a boat secured in San Diego Harbor. His political action committee has been generously subsidized by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. You, Chuck Lewis, have also been following tobacco. It's absolutely incredible here. What can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, let's step back and look at the Republican Party and what it's done with tobacco. Since 1994, the Republican Party has taken five times more money than the Democrats from tobacco interests. Tobacco interests in the last, I believe it's in the last year and a half, have given over $2 million to the Republican Party. And what is most remarkable to me is this is a subject that is controversial. If there is a pariah industry among the majority of Americans today, it's the tobacco companies. And yet, the Republican Party has not had any compunction sidling up to this particular party. We have examples of Haley Barbour, the chairman of the Republican Party, calling state legislatures, urging them to vote for tobacco legislation in the case of Arizona. ABC News reported in the last day or two, Congressman Boehner came in on a tobacco jet. This is the guy who passed checks out on the floor of the House of Representatives from tobacco industry. I have never seen such garish, unabashed special interest access, influence, incestuousness.
What's going to make it stop? I mean, people say it's outrageous. We say the Republicans, Bob Dole in particular, flying around on UST, right. U.S. tobacco jets. But the Democrats are doing it too. And to me, it doesn't seem to matter how much. It's that it's being done at all. What will make it stop?
You know, this is going to sound strange. I actually think this is a case. In our campaign process, we always have two sides, two people, two candidates and parties going at each other. The problem here is they've been well smoked out by both. The tobacco industry has supported both parties. Clinton could make this a major issue. And in fact, you might recall with the nicotine is not addictive issue with Bob Dole, there was a brief moment when it looked like Clinton would seize on that issue. I wonder if in the fall campaign, the Democrats, if it's not Clinton directly, the DNC or somebody won't start running ads.
I think they'll do that only if it gets close and they're in the polls than it is right now, because it's a risky strategy. But the
right.
Republican Party really wants something in this tobacco case. It isn't an abstraction. It isn't
right.
just the ruling class changing money from one pocket to another. The Federal Food and Drug Administration is threatening to classify nicotine as a drug. And the tobacco companies are jumping up and down at this. They don't want this to happen. In fact, Bob Dole has said he would fire the head of the FDA, Dr. David Kessler. It was one of the first things he'd do if he got elected.
That's right.
So they have a clear and obvious interest in the Republicans winning this time, the tobacco industry does.
They absolutely do. And you know, in 93 and 94, you had Henry Waxman bringing in CEOs of tobacco companies and hauling them up there and asking if they knew what the nicotine was addictive and putting them under oath, which they had never been under such intense scrutiny.
In fact, one of them is dead right now, isn't he? Died just a couple weeks ago.
That's right.
The CEO of Brown and Williamson.
Right.
Did he die of lung cancer?
I'm not sure, but he's the one who was bringing suit against the vice president, the former vice president, for doing that interview with 60 Minutes,
wow.
saying that he
oh,
knew
yeah.
about tobacco being addictive, that the CEO did know about it when he raised his hand and swore that it wasn't.
Right.
Amazing. And then, of course, right after that, you have a new chairman, Bliley from Richmond, very tight with the tobacco industry. You don't have any more CEOs under oath. And so the Congress, particularly the Republican-controlled House, has become the blunt instrument to bludgeon the FDA into not regulating nicotine. That is the strategy. That's why it's a 5-to-1 ratio. That is exactly what's going on right now.
Chuck Lewis, let's look for a second at another aspect of campaign finance, and that is the money that goes to individual politicians before they become candidates and that they can't really wash off their hands. And I'm thinking here of Jack Kemp, the newly named vice presidential nominee. He has, according to sources that are in the newspapers, been receiving $3 to $4 million a year in speaker's fees, and maybe as much as another couple of hundred or $400,000 a year in board of directors fees. He's on the board of directors of the American Bankers Insurance Group. He's on the board of directors of something called World Corp, which hold interests in computer and airline industries. He's a multimillionaire, and he's raking it in as fast as he can. Now he is going to be perhaps elected as vice president of the United States. he's expected to perform some sort of Shakespearean transformation at that moment, saying, I renounce everything of yore, and here I am.
Wait a second, Larry. The guy seems like he's very good at transforming from going against Proposition 187 to 4, and he was against affirmative action. Now he was for affirmative action. Now he's against it.
Can he do this for money? I mean, what are we talking about here?
Right. Well, you have a former politician, a former cabinet secretary, who went out and started making a killing on the lecture circuit, and now it's relevant again because he's coming back in the public life. The group that he's been associated with, getting probably 150 to 200 a year, Empower America, this conservative organization in Washington, who are their funders, we don't know. They don't disclose it. The honoraria, we don't know, because honoraria to private citizens, which is what he has been. Now the question is, I think, becoming a vice presidential nominee...
Does he have to disclose?
He does have to disclose, I believe, under the Federal Election Commission rules. I should say we should probably all check this, but my sense is that he is going to have to disclose, and he's going to have to tell how much he got last year, and I think the numbers are going to be...
Staggering,
and people are going to see these relationships, and... here it goes, the eyes of the beholder thing. Some people will say, oh, gosh, he made a lot of money. And others will say, oh, my gosh, look where he went here, he went there, he did that. And again, it comes down partly to your party persuasion, to your allegiance and loyalty to Republicans versus Democrats. And the listeners out there can make their decisions from it. I think it's going to be quite startling.
Chuck Lewis, you've been going around the country, in addition to doing this research, training journalists, giving journalists ideas of how to go about investigating the money trail. You get a lot of questions around the country, sort of expressions of frustration from journalists who may have good intentions, they say, but my editor says it sounds negative if I go after things in that way. How do you deal with that?
Well, usually that's their editors. It's usually not the reporter, it's some jaded editor who has been sitting inside too long or something. I tell them, I don't think it's too negative. I think the public needs this information to make an informed judgment. And I think that, what's the alternative? Does that mean we're all ostriches because it might be negative? A journalist can't make that decision that it's not fit to print because it might depress people.
Do you think it's that journalists and editors are afraid because they've got advertisers? Well, they don't have tobacco advertisers,
right.
For example, Philip Morris. They do have Kraft advertisers, which
exactly.
is owned by Philip Morris. And so that they're just tending away as the mega mergers happen more and more, just away from corporate investigations.
Well, there's no question. I have noticed this. I've talked to a lot of journalists around the country, and their fear is that, especially, and it's particularly onerous, I can't even say that, but at local level, local TV stations, things like that, the idea of them taking on the big powers that be that are advertising on their stations, and it's also true at the networks, I was going to say the same thing, they don't want to name names. They don't mind talking about this in a vague, general, feel-good kind of vanilla way, but they don't really want to get into the nitty-gritty.
Well, the names are themselves sometimes. I mean, the networks are interlocked right. in their board of directors and patterns of ownership with companies like GE, for example.
Right.
How can they name names in a case like that?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, a network, which I should probably not get too specific with, earlier this year did several stories inspired by our book, The Buying of the President, and they never once mentioned a company by name.
Which network?
ABC.
ABC.
Yeah,
well, I mean, the fact is the networks are funding the parties right. and they're covering the parties.
Well, Disney's doing parties out here. Time Warner's doing parties. I mean, they're all doing parties here, schmoozing, and their talent, their anchors and things are the main attraction.
Chuck Lewis is the director of the Center for Public Integrity and author of The Buying of the President. He has a new report coming out in just a few weeks on the money behind both the Clinton and Dole campaigns. Stay with us. We're going to be talking about the Christian Coalition and their Faith and Freedom rally yesterday. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in San Diego, joined by Pacifica's national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky. He's continuing with us, and Juan Gonzalez will be back in the next segment. The Christian right held a Faith and Freedom Festival yesterday to celebrate their power within the GOP.
How many of y'all believe that God has blessed America?
I can play.
Come on now.
Celebrate! Celebrate freedom.
Put your hands together. We got a reason.
Celebrate! Celebrate freedom. Together we will stand. From the streets of New York to the hills of Tennessee. No matter how far you might go, no matter how high you might fly away.
The Faith and Freedom rally yesterday here in San Diego. Elizabeth Dole was scheduled to attend, but she sent Joanne Kemp instead. But certainly Ralph Reed was there, head of the Christian Coalition.
We are here to celebrate faith in God, hard work, fidelity to family, and we are to proclaim loud and clear that this country was made great not by taxing and spending bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., but by faith in God and the traditional family. And in case you haven't heard it from the podium the last 2 days, let me say it so that there can be no doubt. The Republican Party is a pro-life party, and as long as we're here, it always will be. We are inclusive. We are open. We exclude no one, but lest there be any doubt, we will never walk away from the innocent sanctity of human life in the mother's womb. I have in my hand your 1996 Republican platform. There have been some this week that have said they haven't read the platform yet. I don't intend on reading the whole thing this morning, but let me just go through a few of the things that are in here that this ticket and this party stand for. First of all, this platform calls for a human life amendment to protect all innocent human life, born, aged, disabled, infirm, and elderly. It calls for a constitutional amendment to ensure that every single child in America has the same right that every member of Congress and every member of the Supreme Court has, and that is to be able to bow their head and begin their day with prayer in the public schools.
Ralph Reed, executive director of the Christian Coalition yesterday at the big Faith and Freedom rally here in San Diego. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky. We're joined by Sarah Diamond, who is our right-wing watcher and author of a number of books on the subject. Sarah, tell us about yesterday.
Well, the heat was sweltering, and yet about 3,000 people sat through a two-hour rally that began with some of the music that we just heard, and then, of course, a whole lineup of speakers. The event was designed to allow Christian conservatives who live in the San Diego area who are not formally part of the convention to have a chance to participate. So there were buses that came in from several churches in the area, along with buses from the hotels that brought in the Christian Coalition's delegates. So it was kind of a mix of the delegates and the non-delegates from the local area.
You've been watching the rise of the Christian right, Sarah Diamond, since the early 1980s. How would you put the present status of the Christian right in the Republican Party vis-a-vis their growth over the years? Is this a high watermark for them?
I think that this convention has been not really a high watermark, but it is an important juncture because my own analysis is that the Christian right has now become such a mature social movement, such a permanent fixture within both the party and really within the whole political process that what people have been celebrating all week, and I've talked to quite a few Christian right delegates, they are celebrating like crazy this week because they've made it. And Houston, even, their status was still kind of provisional. They were there, they were loud, they were very present, but they were not fully integrated. This time around, they seem less present at one level, and yet, in fact, it's because the movement is so thoroughly integrated into the party that it seems like there's less of a presence. There's actually more. It's a more entrenched presence. It's a permanent presence, and that's why they're celebrating.
Speaking of presence, was Newt Gingrich's presence surprising to you? Was it at all significant?
It was significant because he has said over and over again that it was the Christian right that really helped bring the Republicans to power in 94 in Congress. And the reason for his speech there yesterday was, in a sense, to thank them, in a sense to rally them and get them riled up and excited about this election coming up so that the Republicans can maintain their hold in Congress. The Christian right is very much focused this year not just on electing Bob Dole, but on electing more or keeping the Republicans in Congress and the Senate. And that was really why Gingrich was there yesterday.
And keeping them in line.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they really care about electing Bob Dole? The Christian right?
I talked to a lot of people about precisely that point, because in the last few months prior to the Jack Kemp nomination, there was quite a bit of criticism from people in the Christian right of Bob Dole, and a lot was being said in the last few weeks, if he picks a pro-life running mate, then we'll be satisfied, or if we get our platform plank, then we'll be satisfied. Well, they got the platform and they got their VP nominee, so they're happy, and that's why they're celebrating.
And certainly they have a lot more access. Well, we're going to hear now from the founder of the Christian Coalition, who gave a major address yesterday at the Faith and Freedom Rally, Pat Robertson.
Now, in 1956, 40 years ago, we had a Republican president. His name was Dwight Eisenhower. We had intact families in America. Crime was virtually unknown. Drugs were limited. Our budget was balanced. We were considered the strongest nation in the world, bar none. It was a land of hope and opportunity, where the streets were safe, and where in every single state in the Union, abortion was illegal. It was a land where it was taken for granted that little children could pray in the schools. But ladies and gentlemen, I watched in amazement in 1962 when the Supreme Court of the United States said children can't pray in schools any longer. In 1963, they found something in the Constitution that had never existed before. They said that you cannot teach the Bible and the principles of the Ten Commandments to children any longer. A few years later, they said you can't post the Ten Commandments on the walls of schools. And I watched, little by little, an unremitting assault by the left-wing forces, the ACLU, and the National Organization of Women, and other radical groups who began to hit not only on the prayer and religious life of our society, but they began then to assault the institution of marriage. It wasn't long, starting about 1970, where in almost every state, this left-wing, radical, extremist coalition battered down the walls of intact families and passed what were called no-fault divorce laws. Somebody said that any woman who votes for no-fault divorce is like a turkey voting for Thanksgiving. 3 years later, the Supreme Court found something in the Constitution called the penumbra, a shadow of the 14th Amendment, which said there was a right to privacy, and from that right to privacy in the Griswold case decided about 1954, they said there's a constitutional right to kill unborn babies.
And that was Pat Robertson speaking at yesterday's Faith and Freedom rally to about 3,000 delegates from the convention, along with, well, it wasn't 3,000 delegates, a total crowd of 3,000, including delegates and members of the local evangelical community. Robertson has, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard that exact same speech. He gives the same speech at every single Christian Coalition event. Phil Driscoll, the musician you heard at the beginning of this segment, appears at almost all of the Christian Coalition events. So it's become almost a ritual that we're going, we go to the exact same program.
But isn't it significant that he had to give that speech in a park in the middle of the day in San Diego and not in prime time on television?
It's a departure, certainly, from 92, but nobody seemed fazed by it. I talked to a couple of Virginia delegates while we were all, you know, sweating in the sun, and I said, how do you feel about Susan Molinari having given the keynote speech and about the fact that there weren't really any pro-lifers up on the platform? And they just said, well, you know, that's the way it goes. The Republicans have the right to, you know, put on who they want. And, you know, meanwhile, we're busy organizing, you know, and then they told me what they're doing back home. So I think that, that these people are politically sophisticated enough that they don't really care, I mean, what's on television. They're interested in who's going to the polls, who's going to be electing local officials, where this movement is going in the future, and everything else is kind of beside the point.
Let me quote from Ralph Reed in yesterday's Washington Post, the same thing he actually said to me last week when I was here for the platform committee hearings. He said, if you're a majority, you go out and you broadcast, which by definition means you broadcast to everyone. The problem is that it can turn off as many people as it turns on. What we do, the Christian Coalition, is very different. We narrowcast. We identify our community. We work it better than anybody else can work it. It really is the political equivalent of niche marketing.
Mm-hmm. Right. He's been saying that since 1989 when the coalition was first founded. This was a shift in strategy by the Christian right. The Moral Majority, which was founded in 1979, had this sort of ludicrous idea that, oh, you know, Jerry Falwell, we represent the majority. And it got everybody's expectations up, people in the movement. And when things didn't pan out, they were very disappointed. And, of course, it was ridiculous to suggest that the Christian right represents a majority. So when the coalition was formed in 89, Ralph Reed, very astutely, had a much different presentation, which was, no, we're not a majority. We are an important, significant minority that deserves representation along with everybody else.
And we should say there were a few clips of Ralph Reed last night in a video at the GOP convention, and Jerry Falwell did speak, albeit in the benediction at the end. And it wasn't just any benediction, because within that he said, he was talking about marriage, and he said, and the only legitimate marriage is between a man and a woman. So they did get someone on. You know, yesterday when I was walking into the convention center, there was a very excited woman going through the metal detectors. She was wearing a big red straw hat, red, white, and blue. She'd just come from the Faith and Freedom rally. Her name was Pam Bohannon, and she was a delegate alternate, as she called herself, from the state of Georgia, and she's running for the House of Representatives. And she was particularly excited about the fact that Joanne Kemp addressed the crowd, however briefly.
She brought greetings from her husband as well as from her family, and she just admonished all of us to keep our focus on family values, which is what she's done in Washington all of these years.
In what way has she done that?
She's had a prayer group in her home, the longest, long-running prayer group in Washington, D.C.'s history. Every Friday, she meets with many women in her home. They do a Bible study and a prayer group. And there's even Tipper Gore's a part of that.
Does she consider herself a part of the Christian Coalition?
Well, you would have to ask her that. She considers herself a part of a pro-family, traditional family value, a group of people, which is John Q. America, which is who we are. And we're not members personally of Christian Coalition, but we certainly hold the ideals and the values that Christian Coalition espouses, and we're supportive.
And that's Georgia's alternate delegate, Pam Bohannon, coming from the Faith and Freedom rally. You know, it very much fits in with your point, Sarah Diamond, of there isn't really a radical right here. I mean, here is Joanne Kemp, who is part of this, and this is now mainstream.
And has been for quite some time. I mean, one of the problems, I think, is because of the kind of propaganda that's issued by the Democratic Party, much of the media, certain centrist lobbying organizations that have a political agenda in their whole way of presenting the Christian right, they have for the past 15 years tried to tell people, including people on the left, unfortunately, that these are a bunch of monsters and crazy people who don't have anything to do with you know, mainstream America, and that is totally false. These people could not be more average in you know, quite a few different ways, and it's not at all the case that these people have taken over the party. They are the party. They are the people who have been working campaigning for years and have in a sense earned the right to be the delegates and to, you know, be in the position to be making policy vis-a-vis the platform and the nomination of Jack Kemp. So there's nothing radical about people who support Jack Kemp, who's been a mainstream politician for years, who supported every foreign policy initiative of the Reagan-Bush years, you know, throughout the 1980s, as did the Christian right. There's nothing, you know, really, there's nothing radical about people who want to maintain the status quo in terms of the political economy of this country.
Sarah, the Republican Party now seems to have had many of its state delegations, some estimate as many as 30, taken over by people who are affiliated in one way or another mm-hmm. with the Christian right. They have gotten many of their candidates through the primaries for Senate and for Congress around the country. You and others and me have said that over the years, their electoral success depends on a low turnout.
Mm-hmm.
They can organize people, but once it gets out into the larger population, they tend to lose. You think that's going to be true this year as well?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, because the Republican and Democratic parties are so similar, most of the public is not involved and is tuning out. And this is precisely why it's so important not to portray these people as a bunch of radicals or extremists who are simply violating the rules and winning through deception. That's basically the line that groups like People for the American Way put out. The real radical analysis would be to say, look, let's us on the left go out and mobilize people, get other people involved so that the influence of the Christian right will be diluted. That's the only way to deal with these people. It's not to call them names or try to besmirch their personalities or mock them. It's to get other people organized so that this very permanent presence will one day just be one other faction and not really the dominant faction as we now see it.
You know, we should also point out, in addition to Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson addressing the Faith and Freedom Rally, Dan Quayle, the former vice president, was there, and he gave the exact same speech to the Faith and Freedom Rally in the afternoon as he did to the GOP convention last night.
Our Republican Party represents mainstream America. But be prepared, our Democratic opponents and their friends in the national media will try to portray you and me as radical. Let me ask you, is it radical to cut taxes for working families?
No.
Bill Clinton thinks it is. Is it radical to want to balance the budget?
No.
Bill Clinton thinks it is. Is it radical to offer parents choice in education?
No!
Bill Clinton, he's against parental choice. Is it radical to try to reform the legal system and make it more efficient for all of us?
No!
Bill Clinton vetoed legal reform.
Again, that was Dan Quayle at the Faith and Freedom Rally, speaking exactly the same way he was speaking to the convention. And I should also comment that the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, the committee, is here. They've been here all week. We know that. We spoke to a DNC person yesterday. And they've put out a pamphlet that they have not taken credit for. No one knew who it was. It was just a white pamphlet. And they talk about Quayle, Ralph Reed, Pat Robertson, and a group of others as the extreme team.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of things the Democrats do are very extreme. Some of their foreign military policies and their policies around welfare, what I would consider extreme. I think this is basically empty rhetoric. I think what people, I'm mostly interested in the audience of people who are progressive. I think we have to ditch the name calling, look at what the issues are, and start figuring out for the long term how we are going to sort of break the juggernaut, in a sense, and get people interested in politics enough, again, so that one day we may be able to dilute the influence of the Christian right. That's really the only solution.
Sarah Diamond, thanks so much for joining us. Sarah Diamond, right-wing watcher, author of Roads to Dominion.
The two or three are gathered in his name. He sent and there he will be alive.
You're listening to Democracy Now! From San Diego. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, and I think of no one that could really exemplify that more than our next guest. I'm Amy Goodman, and Larry Venske is with us, Juan Gonzalez is with us, and we're joined by Molly Ivins, a syndicated columnist with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. You've been here for the whole convention, Molly.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're looking good.
Oh, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at this time of morning.
So what's been going on in the Texas delegation of note, Molly?
Well, we have a real interesting delegation. We've got about two-thirds Christian Coalition people and one-third more old-fashioned economic conservative type Republicans. And there's not actually bad blood between them, but there's a certain kind of a bit of slightly horrified curiosity on each side toward the other. One of the O-line guys came up to me and said, you know, I went into a room this morning and there was a bunch of them nursing their babies and telling Jesus stories. And I think the Christians kind of look at these secular drinkers in much the same, gosh, they're not bad people, but boy, are they strange. Unlike that previous lady, I'm actually a little bit tickled to see the Jesus people, as some of my compatriots call them here. I've always thought that politics was about inclusion and giving people who feel powerless a chance to get in and play the power game. And it kind of tickles me to see these Christian right people.
Well, what if you wind up including people whose agenda includes excluding you?
Oh, well, there you've got your problem, of course. No, I'm not saying that there's anything necessarily marvelous about the Christian Coalition's position, but I think it's kind of fun that they're here and playing the game and
Molly,
how it all works.
What do you make of the difference, the vast difference between the almost a rainbow coalition picture that you're seeing on TV of this Republican Party and the reality of the actual delegates and the construction and platform of the party?
It is funny, and it's like what is going on television. What you see on television has so little relationship to this convention. It's just amazing, except that if you watch C-SPAN, you notice when they pan the audience for reactions. I mean, these delegates are just white. I mean, some kind of extra white, much whiter than normal white people, in my opinion.
Well, you wouldn't know from the networks. We were commenting earlier, it's almost like it's a separatist party. It's only black and only women, if you were to look at the podium or to look at who the cameras are focusing on.
But don't the networks show any of the audience?
They focus on individuals, and they've got their mics in front of probably every African-American at least five times a night.
One of the papers this morning has a story about that. I think it's the New York Times. A woman spent the evening in the director's truck of one of the television networks. And apparently the Republican Central Command is constantly calling on the internal numbers saying, why don't you put more of this on? Why don't you focus on that? Just actually pressuring them as they're directing the show to, yes.
Boy, that's
you're not incredulous about this. This is the way stage match.
I'm amazed by that they would be so clumsy. I mean, that's no way to treat journalists.
That's a question. Are television producers and the people who put these things together in any way, shape, or form journalists?
Well, I mean, that is a good question.
47 black delegates here. That's
each
how many
whom,
there are.
Yeah,
each of whom has FaceTime.
And
there were 47 black delegates are 2.6% of the Republican delegates. Mm-hmm. There was a count made of how many black faces were shown during Colin Powell's speech, and it was 20% of the reaction shots were on black people.
Boy, somebody has just, by God, gotten up their little pen and toted things.
Those are the journalists doing that type of work.
I'm waiting for the profiles and courage that we had during the Olympics, you know, those little moments of heroism. Well, now they're going to be for every black delegate at the convention, since we know so much about them at this point. At least we know their expressions.
Oh, that's a good idea.
But speaking of
you have to admit, though, there has been one transcendent moment. I would say perhaps the single most moving moment of my lifetime covering politics. And they didn't even put it on national television. I was just heartbroken because the Repubs didn't have the nerve to put Newt on in prime time. But
oh,
if y'all
unbelievable.
Did not hear Newt Gingrich's speech in which he explained to us that freedom is beach volleyball.
Oh, yes, yes.
You
We've
missed
talked about that.
Something sublime.
In the same breath with mentioning Martin Luther King as the greatest Georgian of this century.
And when he got through and said that, you know, the whole deal about beach volleyball and said, that's what freedom is all about, I swept my forehead. I said, now I understand.
Well, you know, the basic thing, though, is that the bump that this convention is supposed to be giving to the Republican Party has turned into a pothole, because according to the polls so far, Dole's approval rating among voters has dropped 5% since Monday night. How do you explain that?
I don't know. The last I heard was a Washington Post ABC poll that showed it at 19 points, which is not a real impressive game, but let's wait to the end of the week. They should get some.
Now, Molly Ivins, and that's who we're talking to, folks, in case you haven't guessed, I am looking at your pin. Uh-huh. It's all my fault.
It says, and then in smaller letters, it explains, I'm from the media.
What's been the delegates' reaction as they read that?
They like that. They like that. And I find many of them agree with it.
We'd like some buttons to distribute that. Of course, it really is all our fault here at Pacifica. It would be accurate to say that it is all our fault. Molly Evans, what about last night and Liddy Dole?
It's hard. Some of this is just straight personal reaction, and you can't, you know, people's tastes just differ. I wasn't that impressed by it. For some reason, when it wasn't just kind of, you know, the Oprah-like deal, she just didn't seem to me to be very natural. I got a sense that it was very rehearsed. And I mean, you know, poor woman, you have to stand up and make a speech in front of God and everybody, you probably would rehearse. But it didn't seem terribly spontaneous. I'll tell you who I liked last night was McCain from Arizona. Hell of a good speaker. Mm-hmm.
Cried, almost broke down in the middle of that as he talked about Bob Dole wearing
and the bracelet, isn't that?
Name
that
on
is
his bracelet.
An extraordinary story, I believe a true one.
I don't know if anybody noticed, but in McCain's speech, he said, talked about how when Dole came back from World War II, the GI Bill helped him and others get themselves back on their feet economically. Mm. But you'll look long and hard in the Republican Party platform before you'll find the equivalent of the GI Bill to help poor people get back on their feet in this country.
Mentioning that government ever did anything good for anybody seems to be semi-verboten at this deal. There is, speaking of taste, a sort of... Oh, boy, this is really... It's... I don't know how to describe it. Nauseating is the way it comes across to me. I have always thought, it's just a matter of political necessity at this point. Bob Dole, it seems to me, is a man who has handled his disability throughout his life with enormous dignity. And Lord knows the man has worked and worked and worked so that nobody noticed it, so that it didn't get in his way, so that he could do everything that anybody else could do, never whined, never complained. And now here he is at what should be the shining hour of his life, being nominated for president, almost literally having to wave the bloody stump to remind people that he's done service. It's just a horrible, I feel sorry for him.
And then you have Jack Kemp last night at the Embarcadero after the big GOP convention where they had 3,000 people, a lot of them giving $1,000, $1,500. They raised a record $6.5 million at this event. Jack Kemp gets up and says, I will be Bob Dole's right hand. That's right. I will be his right hand.
Oh, dear.
Molly Ivins, our favorite, you talked about your favorite moment, which actually is also mine, mm-hmm. the beach volleyball moment with Newt Gingrich, but the favorite quote to come out of this so far is from Jack Kemp, speaking to David Broder, explaining his flip-flops on affirmative action and rights for immigrants, saying, I might abandon an idea, but not an ideal. I can change politically without changing my principles.
Just a second, she's thinking.
Oh, this is fabulous. This goes right up there with the great Bruce King statement. This is Bruce King, former governor of New Mexico, one of my all-time political heroes, who once said, when accused of having broken his word, but a promise is not a commitment. Now, that's a wonderful Kemp quote. We're putting that in the collection, no question. Now, as long as we're focused on the really important stuff here, have y'all been followed up, great reporters that you are, on this fascinating question of the dangly earring problem? You know, there's a dress code for delegates here.
Oh, we didn't know
and
that.
Yeah. And they are told how to dress and look and all that stuff.
No stripes makes you look fat.
No,
don't pick your nose.
Not that. But, you know, like wear red, white, and blue and stuff like that. And in the women's dress code, it says you shouldn't wear long, dangly earrings. And what I want to know is, did they, like, do a focus group? Is this someone's personal prejudice? I mean, who made long, dangly earrings un-American or at least un-Republican?
Well, I'm glad
and
you got
why?
The message.
Well, who measures the earrings, too? Do we have an earring measurer who comes in and...
No, decides? I think these Republicans are into, you know, like voluntary going on.
What I want to know is, when did flag desecration, which in their platform they say should be a crime, become a fashion statement? Because so many of these people are dressed up in red, white, and blue and stars and things like that.
Well, you really have to relish the ridiculousness. I mean, I love people being silly and making cakes of themselves. I think it's quite delightful in what they like to think is a larger cause. I guess if we have to be serious here for a second and a half, I hate to leave those dangly earrings still dangling now. I think that I have felt this week kind of the way a Republican would feel at a Democratic convention. I mean, I'm feeling like a grumpy old fiscal conservative, kind of the way Bob Dole used to be. You know, wandering around saying, here I am, a hard-headed liberal, having to listen to all these fuzzy-headed, mush-minded conservatives. These people don't understand anything about the bottom line. What do they think they can balance a budget by cutting taxes out of the bank? And it's a funny feeling.
Molly, staying serious for a moment, I'm interested in why the Texas Republicans are so different, let's say, from the California Republicans on the issue of immigration. For instance, Governor Bush has said there will be no Proposition 187 in the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. What happens there between these two giant states, who both have such equally large Latino and immigrant populations?
Right, you're just in it. Hispanic people in Texas. I am so proud of my state. Who knows why we actually turned out to be more progressive than some well-sung place like California, but we are. And I think it's partly because our Tejanos have been there for so long. I mean, they're there before Anglos and fought at the Alamo and all this drill. Plus, in addition to which, I was listening to Governor Wilson explain how the Hispanics here in California had just ruined the economy. And I got to thinking about it. I said, well, y'all just getting the wrong kind of Mexicans is your problem. Because, you see, in Texas, we do not let the Mexicans run the S&Ls. In Texas, you will not find your illegal Mexicans shutting down your defense industry. In Texas, those illegal Mexicans are not allowed to do the mergers and the acquisitions that cause tens of thousands of people to be downsized and laid off like that. I don't know where the hell y'all are getting your Mexicans from, but you get the wrong kind here, so maybe you should try Chihuahua.
What about your governor's position on education, which is also more progressive than California's governor's position on education?
He says educating the children of illegals?
Yeah.
Well, I cannot imagine a larger piece of folly in terms of social policy than deliberately allowing a large pool of people to grow up in this country illiterate. Now, there's a shrewd move for improving the world. Good Lord, where are their minds? No, I really am sort of proud of Texas, and I think, you know, our border has always been porous, and it's always worked the same way, and it's always to our benefit. When the economic times are good and we're all rolling, we like to have a lot of illegal Mexicans come in. I'm sorry to say, in my state, they're still referred to as wets, short for wetback. They don't have a river here on the California border, so they don't call them that. When times are good, we love to have extra workers who work for practically nothing come in. We just exploit them and are quite cheerful about it. And then when times are bad, we shut down and, you know, the pressure goes to shutting it down because, of course, in times of economic trouble, we don't want too many extra workers around. And that whole arrangement has always worked to our advantage. And the idea that they're dumb enough here in California not to recognize what's happening. I mean, here we are in San Diego, for heaven's sakes. Have you ever seen a better example? The economy is absolutely booming. These people are closer to Mexico than Dallas is to Fort Worth right here in San Diego. And their economy is just booming and blooming and growing beyond belief. And, of course, there's zillions of illegal Mexicans quietly cleaning up after everybody around here, all these Republicans, kind of let their convention come to a dead halt if there was an immigration raid.
So would agribusiness in California. 60% of the work in the fields in California, and agribusiness being our biggest industry in California, is done by undocumented workers. 60%.
Well, there's not a single... you look at this town, and it is a living refutation of every single argument a Republican would make against letting in immigrants. Now, I can think of a few arguments that a Republican would not make, which is I do believe that illegals hold down wages. But that's not the kind of thing your Republicans worry about.
Molly Ivins, I have to say, it is such a great shame that we don't get to hear you on 60 Minutes anymore. I mean, I would see you, and I would
come,
smile.
Easy go.
What happened?
There you are.
I want to know the truth.
Easy come, easy go. They for y'all who did not realize this burning matter of media hoo-ha, I was briefly recruited by the 60 Minutes program on CBS. They were reprising the old Shane Alexander, Jim Kirkpatrick routine. You remember, Shana, you ignorant slut. They wanted to reprise that little mini debate, and they roped up me and a couple of right-wing guys, pretty nice right-wing guys,
P.J.
too.
P.J. O'Rourke.
P.J. O'Rourke, your funny conservative. Stanley Crouch, he's a heavyweight thinker. And we were supposed to hold forth in many debates. Now, it's fairly difficult to discuss anything in 60 seconds, although, actually, it does not take that long to say, hang the bastards, which is usually all you need to say. So I got roped into doing this. But the segment never did work. Neither PJ and I were both unwilling to go to New York City to tape a 60-second blig every week. And the result was that it looked real stilted and formal and phony, you know, here's so-and-so speaking from Texas and so-and-so from somewhere else, and there was no connection or something.
Let me ask you a concluding question about the convention. It occurred to me yesterday, as I was realizing how much I hated being here, that I probably will never have to do this again, and neither will anybody else, because I don't think they're ever going to have these again. And the reason why I said to myself they're never going to have these again has nothing to do with the fact that they shouldn't have them. It has to do with the fact that they're not doing well in the TV ratings, and that's what they've become to be about. So do you share my opinion that we're probably never going to have these four-day-long extravaganzas for $30 million, $50 million, and just an hour of primetime TV a night?
Well, I don't do prognostication because I don't really know what's going to happen in the future. Jane Dixon is the one who knows. That seems to me a perfectly reasonable proposition given the poor performance this time. It may yet be that a great and divisive issue will arise and one party or the other will have a beautiful set to in Donnybrook, and of course Ben Jackson, I love a good fight. And it will all make wonderful television and political theater. It seems to me they're going to hold conventions, but your television ain't going to come. And that's fine. I mean, it'll just be another story on the nightly news.
Well, Molly Ivins, I want to thank you very much, and you're certainly not just another commentator. Molly Ivins has been our guest at this hour, and we want to let you know if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin and engineered by Michael Yoshida. Our help today has come from Bill Wax, Kathy Still, Naomi Goffman, Mark Beavis, and I want to thank Juan Gonzalez and Larry Bensky for joining me, Amy Goodman, on another edition of Democracy Now!